Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an audacious GOP plan underway to win the 2012 presidential election by changing the election rules in key states like Pennsylvania. Instead of Pennsylvania's current winner-take-all Electoral College victory, each congressional district will get its own electoral vote, meaning that if Obama wins the state but, as expected, loses in the heavily gerrymandered GOP districts, he would end up with only 8 Electoral College votes to the Republicans' 12. Akhil Reed Amar, professor of law and political science at Yale University, joins us to explain this brazen power grab. Then we'll get an assessment of the upset GOP victory in the heavily Democratic New York district, where they won the once-safe seat held by the crotch-flashing Congressman Anthony Weiner. Democratic strategist Carl Agnew joins us to discuss whether this is a harbinger for the 2012 elections, where, in spite of the Republicans' apparent determination to make sure the economy gets worse so their election chances get better, their cynicism might be rewarded at the polls by a frustrated and angry electorate. Then finally, we'll look into the Eurozone crisis with economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones to get a sense of whether the 17 member states can find the political will to get ahead of the curve and issue Eurobonds to calm the markets as French banks get downgraded because of Greek debt, with Greece teetering on default, while Portugal, Ireland, Spain, and Italy continue to get pounded by the bond markets. Joining us now is Akhil Reed Amar, who is Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, where he teaches constitutional law at both Yale College and Yale Law School. After clerking for Judge Stephen Breyer in the U.S. Court of Appeals in the First District, Professor Amar joined the Yale faculty in 1985. He is also the author of several books, including The Constitution and Criminal Procedure, First Principles, The Bill of Rights, Creation and Reconstruction, and most recently, America's Constitution, a biography. Welcome to Background Briefing, Akhil Reed Amar.
Thanks for having me.
And this story that's come out in Mother Jones about this GOP plan to beat Obama in 2012 is almost as shocking as it is a kind of stealth revelation. I'm surprised that this is not creating more of a stir. What's your reaction?
Well, I hadn't heard about it until yesterday, and when it was explained to me, it immediately aroused my antenna, and I do recommend to all your readers the Mother Jones article on this, which was quite eye-opening. And so precisely because this is so stealthy and bold and unprecedented, it's important that voters in Pennsylvania and across America focus on this issue.
It's also apparently legal. It's brazen and audacious. But my brief description in the opening is that what's happening is that they're going to change because of the heavy gerrymandering in the state, where now they control, the Republicans control both the Senate and the legislature, along with the governorship, and they've already gerrymandered the state pretty heavily now. Instead of the winner-take-all, which is this current system, which I believe most of the states have, 48 of the current states have the winner-take-all in the Electoral College, the change would mean that even if Obama wins the state, but as expected loses in the heavily gerrymandered GOP districts, he would end up with only 8 Electoral College votes to the Republicans' 12.
Yes, that's what's the evil genius, perhaps, of the plan. And you're right, legally, Pennsylvania could, I suppose, simply say the state legislature will pick the electors. That did happen in some states before the Civil War, but it hasn't been our tradition since then. Since then, that's basically 150 years, almost every state, almost every time, lets its voters decide statewide, one person, one vote, every vote counting equally, no gerrymandering, nothing like that. It is true today that there are two states, Nebraska and Maine, that don't do it winner-take-all, but they don't have the same kind of gerrymander issue that Pennsylvania seems to be having in mind.
Well, they're too small, I take it, for that to matter.
Well, they're not only pretty small, the way it works, let's take Maine. Maine basically has two congressional districts, two House districts, and two Senate seats. So that's a total of four electoral votes. The number of electoral votes that the state gets is the number of its senators, two, plus the number of its House of Representatives members, in Maine's case, another two. Now, the way it works in Maine is if you win a congressional district, you get that vote, and if you win the state as a whole, you get a two-vote bonus. That's the senators. Now, if you win the state as a whole, you have to have won in one of those two districts. Just mathematically, that has to be the case. So if you win the state as a whole, you're guaranteed at least three of the four electoral votes, maybe four. So that's not such a big difference from the current system, and gerrymandering really is kind of irrelevant here. The person who wins a majority of the vote in Maine gets at least a majority and maybe all of Maine's votes. Similar thing in Nebraska. Nebraska has five electoral votes, three congressional districts, and a couple of Senate seats. If you win the state as a whole, you have to have won in at least one of those three districts. You win that district plus the two statewide. So there's no way in Maine or Nebraska that you can win statewide and still end up kind of losing the state's electoral vote count. But in Pennsylvania, that could very conceivably happen.
And it does seem that the Republicans who have total political control, not just in Pennsylvania, but also in Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin, what's to stop them doing the same thing there?
And I think the answer in a word is voters. In each of those states, the voters need to decide whether they're going to stand, whether they're going to put up with this. It's true that the Republican Party, through elections, has won in the House, the Senate, and the governorships, and that's perfectly fair. But not all the folks who voted for them, in effect, wanted to be disenfranchised in the presidential election or have very un-American rules of the sort that we haven't had for 150 years in place anywhere be imposed on them. This isn't what Maine does. This isn't what Nebraska does. When you actually really understand the Maine and Nebraska systems, there's no really partisan gerrymandering at the heart of those plans. Lots of folks who voted for the Republicans in Michigan or Ohio or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania might be independents who might feel that really it's up to them to decide in 2012 whether they're going to vote for President Obama for re-election or his Republican alternative. And they're the ones who are basically being dissed, who are being disrespected by this very kind of clever plan. So what's to stop them is ultimately public opinion. The voters themselves who say, wait a minute, you're supposed to work for me. I'm paying for your salary, and you're kind of trying to take the vote away from me in some powerful sense, or at the very least, trying to structure the rules so that we don't really have one person, one vote statewide the way we have had for 150 years in Pennsylvania and Ohio and these other places, at least 150 years. It actually, in almost all states, goes back even further than the Civil War.
Again, I'm speaking with Akhil Reed Amar, who's a Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. Now, we know that the GOP in Pennsylvania is moving ahead with this plan, and Pennsylvania alone could swing the election to the Republican nominee. Do we know whether or not these other key states that we just mentioned, which are totally controlled by Republicans, all of which are very important states, Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin for any presidential election, do we know whether the plan's underway there?
I don't know. I'm not an expert on the politics or the politicians in those states. Until yesterday, frankly, I had no idea that this was brewing, but when I was contacted by Mother Jones magazine and sort of listened after, and my first inclination was to say, oh, don't worry, but the more I listened, the more anxious I got, and this seems to me very important, so you're doing an important public service. At the end of the day, our democracy is what we, the people, make of it. And if ordinary people, voters in all these places, are comfortable with this system, well, then so be it. But if they're not, let's make sure that they know about this before it's done so that they can make their voices heard.
And in terms of the Electoral College itself, it is something of an antique, isn't it? I mean, we had the paradox of Al Gore winning by the popular vote by 560,000 votes and losing in the state by only 527 votes, and thus losing the presidency in the Electoral College. And then conversely, in 2004, Bush was, I think, about 3 million ahead in the popular vote, but he almost lost Ohio, which would have then gone to Kerry.
I like the points that you're making. They're excellent points. I've long been a critic of the Electoral College, and we could talk, if you want, about how its origins are actually very different from what most people were taught in third grade. They're taught it's a big state, small state balance, but in fact, the big state person almost always has won from the very beginning. They're taught it's because the founders didn't really believe in democracy. I don't really think that's the explanation. We could go into why. Originally, it was actually a compromise with slavery, and the Electoral College allowed slave states to sort of have more clout. They could, in effect, count their slaves with a 3/5 discount at a discounted rate. But Virginia, for example, had more electoral votes in 1800 than Pennsylvania, even though Pennsylvania had a lot more free citizens and voters because Virginia got to count its slaves. So that's what it was originally all about. I've never loved it, but here's the thing about it. Even though it's not great, it's not skewed. In 2000, it ended up helping the Republican. In 2004, it might have ended up helping the Democrat. Right now, the way the this is not built into the nature of the universe, but it just turns out at the present moment that the Electoral College will sometimes diverge from the national popular vote, but pretty much without a systematic skew. Sometimes the Electoral College will favor the Republicans, sometimes it will favor the Democrats. Whereas this Pennsylvania plan has a partisan skew to it, and that's what makes it also very different than the Electoral College as a whole.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Akhil Reed Amar, there have been a number of suggestions and plans to reform the Electoral College. I think, why not make it all winner-take-all? I mean, if you can't get rid of it altogether.
Well, there is a plan afoot. In fact, California has recently joined this plan with Governor Brown having signed a California version of what's called the National Popular Vote Initiative. And what this plan would do is, instead of giving all of California's electoral votes to the person who wins, the candidate who wins California, it would give California's electoral votes to the person who wins the national popular vote, as long as enough other states also agree to do the same thing. They haven't yet. About half of the right now, a bunch of states have signed up to this plan, but it won't go into effect until enough do, so as to guarantee that the person who wins the national popular vote would actually have an Electoral College majority. Now, that's changing the system, too. It's a new thing, and some people might not like it. But one difference is that plan, at least as I understand it, is not a partisan plan. Precisely, you're going to move from the Electoral College system that we've had in place for many years to, in effect, a national election system. But that isn't, as I said, partisan because neither system really is designed to favor today the Republicans or the Democrats as such. But what Pennsylvania is doing is trying to come up with a modification of its rules for picking electors that seems very partisan. And that's a new thing and a bad thing.
And hopefully people will only if people get sufficiently outraged will anything be done about it, right? Otherwise, it could be a fait accompli.
Well, that's why it's so important to get the word out. As I said, 36 hours ago, I didn't know anything about this. But when it was brought to my attention, it caught my eye, and I hope it catches the ear of your audience.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Akhil Reed Amar.
Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Akhil Reed Amar, who's Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, where he teaches constitutional law at both Yale College and Yale Law School. After clerking for Judge Stephen Breyer of the United States Court of Appeals, First Circuit, Professor Amar joined the Yale faculty in 1985. He's also the author of several books, including The Constitution and Criminal Procedure, First Principles, The Bill of Rights, the Bill of Rights, Creation and Reconstruction, and most recently, America's Constitution, a biography. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about what Democratic strategy there is for the 2012 elections.
Will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep. But sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Democratic political strategist and founding partner in Kirstein Agnew, Carl Agnew. He has conducted research for hundreds of political campaigns at every level, from municipal elections to congressional and gubernatorial contests, to directing national research and message development for the Gore-Lieberman campaign. He serves as senior advisor to Democracy Corps, a nonprofit advocacy group he helped form in 1999 with James Carville, Stan Greenberg, and Bob Schrum. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Agnew.
Thank you.
And clearly the loss of what was a safe Democratic seat in New York to a Republican, the seat that Anthony Weiner had, must be sending shockwaves through the Democratic Party. Is there any anomalies there or anything you can point to that doesn't suggest other than bad news? I know that, for example, the former mayor, Ed Koch, a Democrat, weighed in on behalf of the Republican. But there has to be, I think, some other explanation here, surely.
Well, there's several explanations. You know, special elections get blown out of proportion disproportionately because there's nothing else for the media to focus on. 3 months ago, in May, Republican was thrown out an overwhelming Republican seat in upstate. That had no larger political, national implications than this does. What's happening and what's been happening for several cycles now, going back to 2006, 2008, 2010, is voters are taking out their frustrations on the dominant party, on the incumbent party. And that is happening in locations, not just who's the dominant party in Washington, but who's been the dominant party in a specific region. Voters are so incredibly frustrated with what's happening in Washington. They're lashing out in any way they can, trying desperately, I think, to send a message to those in power, to those with power, whether in Washington or in local elections, to try to get this message across, to try to, you know, get them to break the status quo. And I think that that's what was happening yesterday in an overwhelmingly Democratic district. You saw the voters lashing out against the Democrats, and it's going to happen in a Republican district in upstate a few months ago, and it's going to continue happening in locations throughout the country until something changes in Washington.
So if it's a plague on all of their houses, how do you develop a strategy here as a Democrat? Because I thought that what the president was counting on in his recent speech to the Congress was that the Republicans are getting an earful when they go home and that he's trying to shame them into action. My sense is that they probably don't want to do anything to improve the economy because they're going to benefit from a bad economy.
If the president's strategy is to shame the Republicans in Congress, there's no hope to that strategy. I think they've proven that overwhelmingly. But I think the fundamental problem is, as you said, the president sought to speak to the country and he went before Congress. I think the Washington-centric point of view that seems to still be driving the administration's agenda is a big part of the problem. Nothing is going to happen in Washington. I think if the president walked in and offered the Republicans everything, and I'm not suggesting that he should, but if he were to offer them everything that they were asking for, they would just ask for something different and move the goalpost back even further. They have no interest and no incentive to actually pass legislation to make this economy better, and I think the administration and Democrats in Congress need to realize that. If they're going to make a difference, they need to get out of Washington, and they need to figure out ways that do not require legislation passing the House or getting more than 60 votes in the Senate in order to make a difference, because if those are their only answers and their only prescriptions, they're going to be frustrated. They're going to go into 2012 with even more frustration and more failures on their agenda.
Again, I'm speaking with Carl Agnew, Democratic political strategist, and we're talking about the loss of a safe Democratic seat in New York that belonged to Anthony Weiner. So how do you then, I mean, clearly the people who captured a grassroots strategy, even though it was largely an astroturf operation conducted by Karl Rove and Dick Armey, are the Tea Party. So is there a left-wing version of a Tea Party anywhere on the back burner?
There isn't right now. I mean, always the party that's in opposition has more energy and more enthusiasm than the grassroots. Certainly, we saw that with Obama in 2008. We're seeing it with the Republicans now. We know from evidence all over the country, polling evidence, and what we just see on the ground, that progressive grassroots are dispirited right now. What it will take to get them enthusiastic will be some sort of an agenda, some sort of a positive image to get behind, but it will also be an opponent. If the opposition in the 2012 race is Mitt Romney, if it's Rick Perry, if it's Michelle Bachmann, whoever it might be, that will rally and focus progressive grassroots in a way that what's happening in Washington right now, a debate that's entirely about process rather than ideas, is never going to do.
But surely there's a world of difference between Perry and Mitt Romney in terms of who the president would benefit from running against. Surely, from a Democratic point of view, Perry would be a gift in a very difficult election year.
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I think that Romney has tremendous problems with the Republican grassroots. I think that there are large segments of the Republican primary electorate that are not comfortable with his religion. I think there are others that are very uncomfortable with the fact that less than two decades ago, he was trying to run to the left of Ted Kennedy for a Senate seat in Massachusetts. He's got a lot of problems in the base, and what those are going to mean in a general election are very different weaknesses than what Perry would present in terms of appealing to middle-of-the-road voters, but could also be just as powerful. So where the electoral math works out, we're not really going to know at this point, but I think all of the Republican frontrunners are severely flawed.
Well, but I think, isn't the point, though, that if Mitt Romney can get through the primary process, then he's a formidable candidate. The best hope for Democrats is that he won't get through the very hard-right Tea Party scrutiny that you just mentioned.
Potentially, but we have to see what happens and how he gets through that Republican primary and what he has to do to get through it. So those are all unknowns at this stage.
I see. So tell me, though, Carl Agnew, what you have in mind about a grassroots strategy. If it's a plague on all of their houses, if there's just this kind of boiling anger back home with their representatives, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, how do the parties differentiate themselves, particularly the Democrats at this point? Because, you know, the Tea Party seems to be driving the Republican agenda, and that's pretty clear what that is. There's not a lot of clarity that I can detect on the other side.
And there's not. And again, having to create an agenda that there's two different ways, really, of doing this. The president should be articulating his ideas and his policy prescriptions, but should not be counting on actually passing them through the Congress. He should be going out to the American people and talking to them about them, and he should be finding ways to make them happen that don't require congressional approval. There's literally billions and billions of economic development or job creation money spread. It's already been allocated by Congress, spread across 9 different agencies through the executive branch, probably 30-some different programs. That money's there, and it's being used in a very bifurcated way right now. The president needs to marshal his resources, nobody has, and maybe reallocate some of that or be a little creative in his efforts. There also, when we look at this economy, we know how disappointing voters are, and we know how negatively they view the economy right now, but there's a lot of good things happening out there. A lot of the new energy ideas that the president has, there are no million-job silver bullets out there. Everyone understands that. But there are good things happening. Small companies, startups, small clusters of companies throughout the country. And there's good news that the president is not trumpeting. And voters don't understand what the new economy that the president wants to create looks like because they've never seen it before. He needs to go out there and show them. He needs to show them the good news. Tell them about the successes that are happening. And I think voters are smart enough to look at some of those and to see how they can scale and to see how they can be successful with a combination of public and private investment. I think the president also needs to go out there and put pressure on the banks and on the companies. We know the companies are sitting on record amounts of profits right now. They're not hiring. The banks are sitting on the money the taxpayers gave them. They're not lending. These companies that are doing good things, that are positioned to grow, that are positioned to be successful in an increasingly competitive global economy, don't have the resources that they need. The president needs to go out there and be their champion. He still has the bully pulpit. He still is an incredibly persuasive communicator. He can put pressure on these banks. He can tell good stories. He can get a message out there that rallies the grassroots and shows people something other than the negativity and the nihilism that they're hearing from the Tea Party.
Well, it looks, though, like the Republicans and the Tea Party have framed stimulus as a dirty word, like a liberal being a dirty word. Stimulus is now a dirty word. And their argument is that we've already tried that and it's failed. And of course, you know, a lot of economists on the left, like Krugman and others, were saying from day one that it wasn't enough. And we know that the Republicans aren't going to cooperate on this latest Jobs for America package, except in terms of tax cuts. You're saying, Carl Agnew, that there's a lot of money floating around that can be used in a creative way. Do you think that the president can reinvent this jobs narrative? Because my concern is that there doesn't seem to be a level playing field in terms of communication here. For example, the deficit narrative is the strongest narrative vis-a-vis the economy. And it's and you know, most economists think it's an insane idea. And in fact, Wall Street repudiated the debt ceiling deal, the hostage crisis resolution. The market tanked as soon as it happened because you're taking $1 trillion out of a sick economy. It doesn't make any sense to any sentient economist. So I'm concerned about not just the need for a message, but who are the messengers that are going to carry this? I mean, do you accept my premise that it's not a level playing field, or I mean, just that Republicans better at using the media than the Democrats?
I think the Republicans have been better at having a consolidated message, and I think that having a negative message is always easier than having a positive one. I think what voters have increasingly rejected is not the ideas, but the process coming out of Washington. To this day, voters have no idea what's in the health reform package. What they hated was the process that created it, and that was what they expressed their displeasure over. And we see the same thing with the deficit, and the brinksmanship that happened with that deal. Voters have very little understanding of the specifics of the plan. What they understand is the ridiculously self-centered approach that both parties took that was all about partisan advantage and no focus, as far as voters could see, on what was actually best for the country. That's what they're rejecting, and that's what Republicans are succeeding in creating, is a dynamic where voters become increasingly less confident in government to be able to accomplish anything, which in turn feeds the cynicism and the negativity that Republicans are counting on to take resources away from government and therefore make it further ineffectual and creates a cycle.
But Carl Agnew, one of the problems with the health care bill is that it was so backloaded that the public have no concept of the benefits there because they're not going to come into 2014. I mean, that to me is inexplicable, but that's apparently the way it was crafted.
It was, and you know, I wouldn't pretend to know enough about the specifics of health care policy to say whether or not that was necessary in order to do it right. What I do know is that nothing was communicated to voters about how it was going to benefit them, either short-term or long-term, in a way that was consistent and persuasive.
So you were saying that there's no way in the world that Democrats or the president can develop a strategy that would shame the Republicans into doing the right thing for America, particularly with so many people out of work. And it just does seem extraordinary that these policies that have been put in place, and particularly with this debt ceiling deal, seem to unnecessarily impoverish millions of Americans. We just learned from the Census Bureau that 46.2 Americans live in poverty, many of them children. It doesn't sound like the basic appeal to compassion and decency is working, if you judge by the Tea Party CNN presidential presentation the other night, where Ron Paul was asked about a hypothetical question about a young person who couldn't afford health insurance and had a terrible accident. What should be done? And Ron Paul said, well, you know, everybody's responsible for their own freedom of choice. And then people and Blitzer said, well, would you cut him off and let him die? And people in the audience said, yeah, they cheered. So it seems to me that there's a kind of cynicism out there in the electorate. Do you think that there is any possible traction in appealing to the better angels of our nature?
Yeah, I don't think that we should confuse Tea Party primary voters who go to a Republican debate with persuadable voters who will actually determine this election. They're very, very different. I think that there is, but again, you have to be able to break through the profound and I think well-earned cynicism that these voters bring to the table. You have to be able to show them that something works. They're being, I think, a little bit selfish and a little bit short-sighted and saying, you know, I want to keep what's mine. I want to do as much as I can to take care of myself because I have no faith in government or other institutions to do right by me. And it's a short-sighted selfishness, I think, that's taking hold. If we can communicate, I think that the vast majority of Americans still believe in the common good. They still believe the government has a role to promote the common welfare, but they're not sure the government can actually do that job anymore. It should. They believe that. But they're not sure if they have the confidence in it to do so anymore. And they don't want to see any more of their money wasted on inefficiency and corruption. They'd rather keep it for themselves if that's where it's going to go. But if it's actually going to go to make a difference, if the schools are actually going to educate the children, they're happy to fund the schools. The schools have to prove that they're going to do that before people want to give them any more money. So that's the situation that we're in now. I think voters are being a little bit selfish, and they are being a little bit short-sighted, but it's because of this growing skepticism and cynicism toward government. We have to be able to show results, and that's where, again, I think it's incumbent upon the president and Democrats to get out there and to tell some of the good news that's happening in this economy, not to let the bad news and the nihilism of the Tea Party dominate the debate.
Well, but hasn't, to some extent, the president undercut the assets that the Democrats have, because the Democrats have been the champions of protecting Social Security and Medicare. And we know from that earlier by-election in upstate New York, where the Democrats had the opposite effect to what happened with the Wiener seat, where the Democrat won in a Republican district because of the Medicare issue and protecting Medicare. And now the president's suggesting that we can put Medicare up on the block as well. I wonder whether that basically is self-defeating for a Democratic leader.
Well, yeah, this is one of those places, and I think we saw similar dynamics in the lead-up to the 1996 election, where congressional Democrats and the White House are going to see their short-term political interests perhaps diverge. I think congressional Democrats understand that's not a place that they can go. That there's real vulnerability for Republicans on these issues, and that they need to make sure that they hold the line and take the right course. The president is trying to, you know, as we've heard for years now, trying to position himself, it seems, as the adult in the room and the person who's willing to hear both sides and try to reach some kind of an agreement. That hasn't gotten him very far policy-wise thus far, but we'll see how it plays out over the next year.
Well, just to finally sort of to wrap this up, Carl Agnew, in terms of a cynical electorate and a skeptical electorate, I think you've made a very, very clear case is that it exists and it's in effect a plague on both of their houses, and that anything to do with Washington is greeted with a great deal of skepticism, if not scorn. In that environment, is it possible that the president could expose the basic cynicism of the Republican strategy, which seems to me to be fundamentally un-American? If you have a situation where we have a very sick economy, where millions of our fellow Americans, 46.2 million, are living in poverty, many, many are losing jobs, and if the European Eurozone goes south, we'll probably have even deeper recession. There is, you know, it's the right thing to do is to get people back to work. That is pretty manifest. And it seems to be un-American to deliberately want the economy to get worse in order to improve your selfish political career. And that seems to be, I think in fairness, that is the Republican strategy. They're not cooperating with him because there's nothing in it for him.
It's true whether or not you can convince the voters. The problem here, I think, is that voters at this point are unsure what they get from the Democrats, what they can count on. They have very little faith in the Republicans, very little, and they have almost zero confidence in the Republicans that actually have a plan to get the economy back on track. But they believe at a minimum they get reduced government spending, less waste, less inefficiency if they put Republicans in power. So they get that bare minimum guarantee if they vote for a Republican. And right now I'm not sure if they know what they get when they vote for a Democrat. And I think that's the problem. The Democrats have to let voters know what is it that you get when you vote for a Democrat. And right now, voters aren't really sure.
Well, Carl Agnew, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Carl Agnew, who's a Democratic political strategist and a founding partner at Gerstein Agnew, a Washington, D.C.-based political strategy firm. He has conducted research for hundreds of political campaigns at every level, from municipal elections to congressional and gubernatorial contests, to directing national research and message development for the Gore-Lieberman campaign. He serves as senior advisor to Democracy Corps, a nonprofit advocacy group he helped found in 1999 with James Carville, Stan Greenberg, and Bob Schrum. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the crisis in the Eurozone.
We believe in your power to lead. words you break down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who is currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She is the author of the book, Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephanie Griffith-Jones.
Very welcome. Happy to be here.
And clearly there's a lot of anxiety about what's happening in Europe. The Secretary of the Treasury is going to be going over there on Friday for a meeting in Poland with the finance ministers of Europe. He's already urged that European leaders act more forcefully to resolve Europe's escalating debt crisis, and saying that they've been behind the curve, which seems to be the case from the beginning. Other ministers are warning of a vicious circle between sovereign debt, bank funding, and negative growth. So where would you peg this crisis at the moment, Stephanie?
I think Treasury Secretary Geithner is right that governments have been a bit too slow to move forward. But I think also markets have been too fast. I think markets, when they are caught by these waves of pessimism, are heard a lot and exaggerate. I think that the problems, of course, in Europe are serious. The markets are overreacting. And governments should move more quickly. I think there are some interesting measures that could be taken. One could think of further declines in interest rates. The ECB actually has some space to lower interest rates. And perhaps most interestingly, one could think about Eurobonds, which is collectively guaranteed European bonds, for example, up to 60% of GDP of the debt of individual countries, guaranteed by all countries, and particularly by Germany and France. And this kind of measure, I think, would stabilize the market.
Well, of course, George Soros has been calling for that for some time, and apparently he's quite concerned. The Germans have not shown, well, they haven't exactly jumped at that proposal. Where does it stand, the Eurobond proposal?
Well, there is, I think, growing support for it. For example, President Barroso has just said that the European Commission is about to come out with concrete proposals. I understand that there are a lot of informal discussions about it. It is actually quite understandable that the Germans are unwilling, because it might slightly increase their cost of borrowing and make them have some contingent liabilities. But I think it would be a very efficient way of calming the market and of lowering the cost of borrowing for Greeks and other countries. Because in these crises, like in developing country crises, they become unsustainable, not so much because levels of debt are high, which is certainly the case in Europe, but also because the interest rate at which the countries have to service that debt becomes unacceptably high. So if you can break that vicious circle, you can actually make the debt sustainable and allow the most important thing, which is for European countries to start growing. And to the extent that they grow, not only will their populations benefit, but the debt becomes more sustainable. So it is actually in the interest of everybody involved, including the bank, to facilitate the solution which allows for growth. And I think this dimension has been actually missing. And very few people like Joe Stiglitz and Paul Krugman have been stressing the need for growth-oriented policies.
Well, but the opposite, of course, has happened in Greece. And there was apparently a telephone call between the Greek Prime Minister and the French President and the German Chancellor. They're all reassuring the world that Greece is an integral part of the Eurozone, but you know, the choice simply is between an orderly default or a disorderly default. That seems to be the reality. And when you talk about growth, it seems that these austerity programs that are demanded of these countries have the reverse effect.
Exactly. Well, that is one of the problems, is that we have in Europe an imposition by the financial markets, by the IMF and the major credit countries, on a number of countries to have austerity packages, You have countries like the UK, which have self-imposed on itself without pressure from the market austerity. And then you have countries like Germany, which could perhaps grow more because they certainly have space. And of course, equally worrying is that in the US, you have a very sharp slowdown of growth. So except for the emerging markets, tendencies reinforce themselves within Europe and globally. And I think this is very bad news.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She's the author of the book, Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. So we've got the Treasury Secretary going to a meeting on Friday of the finance ministers. There's a great deal of concern in both the European markets and the global markets that the Greek default, in fact, has been a reality for some time. When we talk about being behind the curve, it does seem that this has been pretty obvious that something like this was going to come for some time and that the situation was unsustainable. Even at this point, after the reassuring words from Angela Merkel and Sarkozy after their conversation with Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou, you still get the impression that Greece is going to default. So how is that going to be managed? Or they can't continue to sort of pretend it's not happening, surely.
No, I think that there will be a number of measures taken. My suspicion is that Greece in the end will not default, certainly not in the next few months or even year. I think that there will be, for example, an acceleration of purchases of bonds by the European Central Bank, which could help lower the spread on Greek debt and on debt of other countries. There may be a more serious discussion of euro bonds, and there may be hopefully a ratification of the expansion of the European facility. My impression is that something like a default would be very negotiated and would be, if it's done cleverly, the key is Greece has a debt reduction that is done in a way that where the major credit countries are standing behind it and where contagion is stopped. The risks are not really so much of a Greek default, but of it spreading to other European countries. And I think that if it can be managed, not talked about so much, I think one of the many mistakes that policymakers have made is to talk so much about the need for haircuts, the possibilities of default, rather than do it over a weekend.
Well, that's what Angela Merkel has been saying, right? She's castigated people for that kind of talk and said that...
Exactly. Although she herself was in the past a little bit guilty of that.
Right.
But I think she's now very clear about the fact. There is this very strong commitment. And, of course, there are a lot of difficulties. But I suspect that there will be a ramping up of measures from Europe. I think one of the problems is that market actors tend to demand certain measures, and then when these are taken, then they demand more. So I think there also needs to be some kind of better coordination between governments and the private sector, because private financial sector, because they have a joint interest in this crisis not getting worse. So they should act in a coordinated way. And I think if Germany takes the lead on that and calls, for example, the big banks, the big hedge funds, this could help. And of course, support from the US, support actually from the emerging market, like China, like Brazil, may also be very helpful.
Well, China is apparently, and whether they've offered or they're interested in buying some of the Italian debt.
Yes, and as well as Italian assets.
Well, I think it's that's what they're after, isn't it? I mean, they're after the assets, aren't they?
Well, I mean, assets to be privatized, like your company.
Right, yeah. I think
the Chinese are much more interested in that rather than in the debt, although they have, as you say, been buying, for example, Greek debt. I mean, China has no interest in a major recession in Europe. It's a significant market for it, and it may therefore step in to help. That would be, it's a very new feature of the world economy. I mean, this is one source of hope, that, like, where we have a big difference in the 30s, where the majority of the world economy, which was in Europe and the United States, went into crisis. But luckily, the moment, the emerging markets still countries are still growing very fast. I mean, they're not completely immune from contagion. But at the moment, they're growing very fast, and so they can continue to provide markets. And they have very large reserves, so they could continue. They can provide also funding if they wish so. For example, we have $4.3 trillion of assets in sovereign wealth funds.
Well, doesn't that strike you, though? It certainly strikes me as a bit of an irony that the emerging economies of China, India, Brazil, etc., are the ones that are bailing out the older ones.
It is an incredible irony, as you say. And another irony is that the developing countries or emerging countries had always asked for an orderly debt restructuring mechanism because they had suffered from crises in the past. And the developed countries didn't want to do that. And a lobbying from their own bank. And, of course, if this mechanism existed for an orderly sorting out, this would have helped now, paradoxically, the European countries. But it's an incredible shift. It's so quick that it's the emerging countries that are doing well, and it's the advanced countries that are in trouble. I think it's partly because the developing countries had so many crises in the past, and they learned the lessons that, for example, prudential regulation is limiting the role of the financial sector by prudent regulation is absolutely key to avoid these very costly crises. Whereas in the developed countries, both in Europe and in the United States, there was a feeling that financial markets were very sophisticated and very wise, and therefore that they could be completely liberalized without adequate regulation. And unfortunately, we are now paying the cost of that. So I think one of the lessons looking further down the line of this financial crisis in developed countries is that we again have to re-regulate the financial sector so it does its job, it serves the needs of the real economy and doesn't create problems for the rest of the economy, doesn't undermine.
Well, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, it's hard to imagine how anybody didn't see what happened in 2008, and you've written about it, Time for the Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. That, of course, I would think has made a lot of people in the world, and the sovereign wealth funds and others, pretty leery of Wall Street. And we still have what the percentage of our economy that's in the finance sector has been growing. And Wall Street has been fighting tooth and nail against Dodd-Frank, which is apparently not exactly a tough legislation. So certainly in terms of attitude, I don't get the impression that anybody on Wall Street has been chastened by what's happened.
You're exactly right. I mean, I think that the lobbying from the financial sector is undermining, for example, Dodd-Frank bill, undermining attempts at regulation in Europe. And I think this is very damaging to these economies for two reasons. One is because this could lead to future crises. And secondly, because we need a functioning financial sector that does what it is supposed to do, which is to manage risk and to finance small and medium enterprises, finance long-term investment, provide safe deposits for households, finance mortgages in a sustainable way. And if we do not have it, the West will keep slipping back. These advanced economies will continue slipping back and will have less and less ability to compete with emerging countries and indeed deliver the welfare that people deserve. So it's really a very worrying thing that after these very large crises, the society is not able to regulate the source of the problem, which is in many ways the financial sector.
Well, I think the reasons for that are pretty clear in the unholy nexus between the financial sector and Capitol Hill and our politicians.
Exactly.
I know the American people are fed up with their politicians, but you know the irony is, of course, they vote for them.
Yes, exactly.
Much as they frustrated by them. So again, I'm speaking with economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. So what do you make then of the credit rating agency Moody's downgrading the two largest French banks after reviewing their exposure to Greek debt. That's Crédit Agricole and Société Générale. A third bank, BNP Paribas, apparently is being now reviewed for a possible downgrade as well.
I think it was a bit problematic, but the downgrading was actually not too dramatic, and it went down to the same level that Standard & Poor's had. So it's not a major downgrading, I think. It reflects, of course, concern with a quite large exposure to Greece and to the other periphery countries. But I don't think that is it just sort of acknowledges reality. I think there is a broader problem with rating agencies, which is that they are very, as economists say, pro-cyclical, in the sense that they discover what is obvious when it's already happened. And they do not warn of the problems ahead of time. But I think there is also some need to regulate the rating agencies and to make them improve their methodology so they warn us of problems when they are accumulating and not accentuate crises in the bad times.
So just in closing then, just to get a sense of the word crisis is used all the time. So is it a crisis? Will it be a crisis? Are we being Cassandras, or how much are the Europeans, you know, not being proactive? Because that's been the critique, and it was just delivered by the Treasury Secretary, that the Europeans have been behind the curve. So where's the confidence that if the Eurobond solution, which is the one that George Soros and others have been calling for some time, if that's starting to get some traction, how quickly can they get their act together and just stop this hemorrhaging and pounding the markets? Because, you know, the markets smell blood and they go crazy.
Exactly. But I think these European leaders have taken more actions than have been given credit for. They tend to act too slowly. If, for example, the kind of actions that are being taken today would have been taken a year ago, I think the crisis wouldn't have spread from Greece. But I think there's a sort of quick learning curve. They have been quite pragmatic, for example, in allowing the ECB, the European Central Bank, to buy bonds. They've even now widened it to buy Italian and Spanish bonds, which I think is positive. And hopefully they can move forward quickly to issue these common euro bonds. And one feels that European governments, which of course are many governments, much more difficult than for the United States, divided as the U.S. government is between the Congress and the presidency, but there is still only one country. In Europe, in Euroland, you have 17 countries, so it's very difficult to coordinate. But they need to accelerate the level of their action, they say. On the other hand, they have to think about ways of slowing down the market. We have too many clever market mechanisms, like short selling and naked short selling, that should perhaps be banned or banned further, so that markets can slow down a little bit. And financial actors should think a little bit medium term. Because the European economy is not really that bad. It has many, many strengths. So they should think about long-term fundamentals with many, many advantages. Many strengths, and not just the latest item of bad news, which is what they tend to focus on.
Well, that's because they can make money out of short selling. So I think your point's well taken. I thank you so much for joining us, Stephanie Griffith-Jones.
Great pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who is the Finance Market Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She's the author of the book, Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis.
So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with this amazing story that's been broken by Mother Jones, that the Republicans in Pennsylvania, they've got a trifecta there. They control the Senate, the House, and the governorship. And they're planning on changing the Electoral College rules, where, of course, Pennsylvania, being a key swing state, is vital to the election of the president through the Electoral College. And they are going to change the rules. So instead of it being a winner-take-all, if Obama were to win the state, but as expected, lose in the heavily gerrymandered GOP districts, he would end up with only 8 Electoral College votes to the Republicans' 12. So this is the scheme, or the scam, if you will, that the Republicans are going to change it to a system similar to what 2 states have, Maine and Nebraska. But it will have, whereas it doesn't matter with those small states, it will matter incredibly in terms of the presidential campaign. And it's not inconceivable that now, because they control Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan, other key states as well that are now controlled by the Republican legislatures and the governorships, they could do the same thing. I spoke with Akhil Rita Maher, professor of law and political science at Yale University, and he was very alarmed about this and this new development, and feels that the word should get out because, seriously, this is an unconscionable power grab, and it can only be stopped by sufficient national outrage. Then we talked about the Democratic loss of Anthony Weiner's seat to a Republican, a big upset there. And I spoke with a Democratic strategist, Carl Agnew, who basically said, you know, the Democrats don't have a message. You know, nobody much likes the Republicans or trusts them. But in very simple terms, people expect, don't expect much, but they know that they will spend less and be more responsible, and they, you know, they don't hear a damn thing from the Democrats. That's the problem. There is no narrative on the Democratic side, and the president, of course, is about to give away a lot of the Democratic strengths, their protection of Social Security and Medicare. So it's a pretty pessimistic assessment of the landscape. And then I spoke with an economist about the Eurozone, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, to try and find out whether the 17 member states can get their act together, because they are clearly behind the curve. It looks like they may be able to come up with some plan to sell euro bonds to stop the bleeding in Greece. There's been the French banks were just downsized, or downgraded, I should say, because of the amount of Greek debt they're holding. So I guess it wasn't totally reassuring, but it wasn't that bleak. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.